All right. It's the sex sermon, every minister's favorite. One of the signs of a sexually healthy congregation is one that's willing to talk about sex and willing to talk about it on Sunday. And it may seem odd that I showed that particular video at church, but I think that it illustrates the basic point at which I want to get today, which is the difference between what we often teach, even our children, through our culture, through our media, through our politics, and what is real and true are worlds apart. That oftentimes we don't give accurate information, we don't help people know what is to be true, and it causes problems in the real world. This great divide between the real and the true can have its place in its fantasy life. However, when it is combined with a long history of puritanical attitudes about sex and sexuality, it can become dangerous. And let's remember, those puritanical attitudes are in the foundation of our religious community in the Unitarians, who started out as Puritans, and who actually lived a lot of those puritanical values well into the 1900s. In their book, The Ethical Slut, by Dossie Easton and Catherine List, they put it this way. Our culture positively worships self-denial. We can certainly say that we see the path of sex negativism and living in sexual deprivation as a harmful one. Self-loathing, hatred of one's own body and sexuality, fear and guilt over one's own sexual urges are the outcome. We see ourselves surrounded by the walking wounded, by people who have been deeply, if not irrevocably, injured by fear, shame, hatred of their own sexual selves. We believe that happy, connected sex is the cure of these wounds, that it is important, possibly even essential, to most people's sense of self-worth, to their belief that life is good. We have never met anyone who had low self-esteem at the moment of orgasm. This self-denial permeates every aspect of U.S. culture, from our media, to our churches, to our work lives and relationships, and even the ways in which we raise our children. Just this week, it was reported that the eldest child of the Duggar family, Josh Duggar, sexually molested his sisters and another family friend at the mere age of 14. Some of you may have heard of the Duggar family from the TV reality show 19 Kids and Counting. This is a reality show that follows the life of one Arkansas family who follows the Quiverful movement. Quiverful people believe that it is their duty to have as many children as possible to literally create the army of believers that will save the world. In addition, the Duggars follow strict rules for courting, for dress, and conservative Christian values. Sex is not something discussed. It is saved for after marriage and for the right moment. It is no surprise that in a family that limits and controls all information about sex and sexuality, that their son would act out. What is more concerning in the story of denial of sexuality is that once discovered, his family strived to cover up the misconduct. They failed to follow through on treatment for Josh or counseling for the girls that he touched. Now, let's be clear, this is a symptom of a larger problem. It would be easy to demonize the Duggar family, which is not the point here. The point is that in a society that is becoming increasingly controlling in how it disseminates information to children through abstinence-only education, shaming of any kind of sexual activity, though more for girls than for boys, and leaving the only main depictions of sexuality to the fantasy world, we must recognize that as a society, we're in trouble. The 1960s changed the face of sex forever. Who was around for the 60s? Remember some of that? Yes. And all I can say is thank you for that. In fact, it is because of the sexual freedom and experimentation of the 1960s that the original Unitarian Universalist sexuality curriculum about your sexuality was created in response to parents who didn't know how to help their children grow up in the 1960s and beyond. Among the more controversial aspects of the curriculum then, even as it is today, were pictures depicting real-life encounters, both amorous and sexual in nature. The goal was to demystify sex and portray a real picture for children and youth who were increasingly being exposed to unrealistic standards for relationships, both amorous and sexual. These past couple of years, we have seen perhaps one of the most dangerous examples of this break between reality and fantasy in the 50 Shades of Grey franchise, both the books and the movie. What is most dangerous about this franchise is not that it displays BDSM, bondage, domination, submission, sadism, and masochism, as play, but rather the lack of ethically healthy relationships that are portrayed. In her book, Love Does No Harm, Sexual Ethics for the Rest of Us, Reverend Dr. Marie Fortune writes it this way: I start from what may sound like a negative place, doing the least harm. Why not doing the most good? Or making justice, you may well ask? These are the vision of possibility for which we may strive in relationship, but doing less harm is probably what we are capable of. Doing least harm is a realistic and tangible goal to set ourselves. The Hippocratic Oath from the 5th century BCE requires physicians to keep patients from harm and injustice. This simple and profound expectation is essential to love making justice in any relationship. The key thing being that in an ethical, realistic relationship, we do no harm to others. And what I would maintain is that as a society, we are doing harm by not talking about sex. By having even the video we watch today seem circumspect, instead of being healthy and important information for adults to have. How do we maintain healthy relationships when what we see predominantly in movies are women equivocating to men, almost rapey sex scenes or sex scenes that don't show the noises and stickiness and uncertainty and the curiosity of learning about your lover, but somehow create these beings that magically know just exactly how and what to do in a sexual relationship? Anybody had that experience? They just knew what to do from the very beginning? No, because that's not how we operate. In fact, it's easy to argue that the healthiest relationship is the one in which we can be messy and uncertain, in which we recognize that relationships are imperfect and holy. So how do you do the least amount of harm, or how do you do no harm in a sexual life? Again, I return to the book, The Ethical Slut, and while I know the title is provocative, it is a book about polyamory communities, but it has a great sense of explaining healthy relationships and sexual living. And so I share some of the wisdom from this book. Most of our criteria for ethics are quite pragmatic. Is anyone being harmed in the relationship? Is there any way to avoid causing harm? Are there risks? Is everybody involved aware of those risks and doing what can be done to minimize them? And on the positive side, how much fun is it? Imagine that as a metric for ethics. How much fun is it? What is everybody learning from it? Is it helping someone to grow? How many of you can think of a place in society where sex is described as a way to help you grow? Not many places for that, is there? Is it helping make the world a better place? There's a good one. Is sex helping make the world a better place? I would say if it is not helping making the world a better place, it's not a sexual relationship you should be in. It is not doing you or the world any good. In other words, is it making you more of a person, making all the people you are in relationship more of a being, so that when you go out in the world, you share that joy in your life? You don't have to share the details of your sex. Come on. That's not what we're saying. So there are a few key things, kind of like our no-go-tell rules for children, that are important to help adults and help our society come into a healthier relationship with sex. The first is always consent. Perhaps one of the most disturbing scenes, at least in the movie, I will own that I have not read the books, is a point at which the Mr. Gray decides that he wants to try something, and the girl is not interested. And he just kind of says, oh no, just give it a try. The thing about consent is that it needs to be full consent. If it is coercive in any way, it is not consensual. Oftentimes when a person says no, it doesn't mean no forever, but it does mean that trust needs to be built. Consent implies that we respect the needs and pleasures of the other person. We see this failure of consent in all kinds of ways, not the least of which has been the bastion of rapes on college campuses in recent history, among many other things. But perhaps what is most disturbing in our very Christocentric culture is a tendency towards obedience in all things that removes from particularly children and youth the ability to issue consent to an adult in power, because the first rule given to them is that of obedience. We are not an obedient lot as Unitarian Universalists, so that's not a massive concern, but it is something we should be aware of in the lives of our children and our youth and even ourselves in relationship with others. The second thing is honesty with oneself and with the people around you. Know thyself. Be aware of what you're interested in. Be aware of what you need. The third thing is to recognize ramifications of your sexual choices. This is perhaps what abstinence education has done to most harm people in today's society, because we prevent our children and our youth from knowing the ramification of the choices that they will make into the future. And I should note, when I say children, I'm not talking about actual sex. With children, we're talking about relationships, friendships, and how to have healthy ones. And why we talk about bullying with children is because how they respond to bullying in their early life says a lot about how they're going to respond to abusive or non-abusive relationships in their later life. So the ramifications of those sexual choices, helping them understand and helping ourselves understand the impact of the kinds of things that we engage in. How does it impact our partner or partners? How does it impact our children, our loved ones? Recognizing the ramifications of our choices. The fourth thing is to be respectful of the other person's feelings. To recognize that their feelings are their own, yes, and when you are in a relationship with someone, the best thing you can do is listen. The majority of people in the United States have either experienced sexual abuse or rape, or know someone personally that it is happening to at the time it is happening, and often feel unsafe to report it. Being respectful of others' feelings means risking our own integrity and safety to help another person not experience pain and violence. In some cases, doing the least harm means speaking up when you may be afraid for your life. Respect of others' feelings means being present to the needs of your lover, to the person that you spend your days with, to know that their feelings matter, and yet not to take them on as your own. Which leads to the fifth thing and final thing, which is to own one's own feelings. And I actually think this is perhaps at the top of the list, because we have a lot of work to do when it comes to being aware of our own feelings as a society and as individuals. And perhaps the most common place where we see this come up is in the issue of jealousy, of feeling like we have ownership over another person because we love them, which is complicated for a whole lot of reasons, not the least of which is that it's biologically impossible to control someone's attraction to other people. In fact, I promise you right now that every single person in this room, whether in a relationship or not, will see somebody that they're attracted to in the next 24 hours, because that's healthy and normal. It's what we do with that information that becomes the question. Now, I have a friend who likes to say, I don't believe in monogamy, I believe in fidelity. And he actually teaches BDSM classes across Indiana. And his point in saying that was that at the end of the day, you keep your commitments to the people you are committed to. So if you have promised to love one person, you love that one person and you don't get into relationships with others. That doesn't mean you're not going to turn your head and see someone else's beautiful or whatever, but you keep that promise. Or if you're like Dan Savage, and I know many of us are not, but if you are like Dan Savage in his use of being monogamish, which is identifying healthy relationships of lifelong standing, say you've been in a relationship for 50 years, in his humble opinion, if you only had one or two affairs, that was a good relationship. That's being monogamish. It means holding fidelity to the person that you've committed to for life while recognizing the boundaries of your own needs. But whatever comes into that, whatever your own rules for each of your relationships are, you keep the promises that you make. And you recognize that it is healthy and normal to feel jealousy, to feel territorial, and that there is no need to react or to respond to it. So there are five things: consent, honesty with yourself and with others, recognizing the ramifications for sexual choices, respect for others' feelings, and respect for your own feelings. In a world where you have to ask the question like this: your partner is playing World of Warcraft online. Your partner's avatar has sex with another avatar, all on the computer. Were they unfaithful? Right? Not an easy question to answer, I'll tell you. Here is how it works with these ethical rules. You are honest with your partner. Yes, my elf did have sex with that dwarf. You recognize the ramifications of those choices that you made to have your avatars have sex, and you respect the other person's feelings. And the other person may not care, it's just pixels on a screen, or it may be deeply painful to them that you would do that. Whichever it is, you respect their feelings for it, and you respect your own, and you redefine the boundaries of your relationship. In a world where we get to ask such questions, where people are meeting more and more online and through electronic communication and social media, these are the important questions to ask. The ethics of sexuality is not simple, but in a society that prevents us from talking about it, that makes it something that's taboo even after the sexual revolution of the 1960s, we are faced with difficult moral choices in how we live our lives and how we help our children and our youth live those lives. Unitarian Universalism, at least since the 1970s, has said sex is something we're going to talk about and we're going to make it real, just like the video we watched. And at the end of the day, we're going to make it just as Paul said in Romans, about loving your neighbor as yourself, and that anything that does not live into that love does not fulfill the promises we make each other in our relationships, no matter how messy they may be. So, may you have fun. May you enjoy sex. No matter how old you are, people have sex well into their hundreds. It's not something that's limited to the youth of America. Again, one of those falsehoods of television and books. I love making the older folks blush. That's fun. It's about having a lot of fun and being healthy and enjoying life, because we believe in saying yes to life, right? Do we believe in saying yes? Yes. Good. That concludes today's sermon.